From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, an update on the Flint water crisis settlement from the state. And we speak with an artist who's taking her explosively blooming visual art to the Thumb region.
Like if you go into a building that's been closed up for quite a while and you see cobwebs everywhere, but instead of cobwebs, we've got flowers.
Also, we'll talk about supply chain issues plaguing the auto industry.
There were storms earlier this year in the south that shut down some production, and that put automakers behind. They're still trying to ramp up production from when they were shut down for 8 weeks during COVID. So it's just been the perfect storm.
Plus, a plague of a different sort in Michigan, mosquitoes.
From this exorbitant amount of rain in many areas, we're hatching out eggs from, in some cases, many years.
Those stories just ahead on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what's going on behind the scenes with American automakers' shortage of new vehicles?
They're still trying to ramp up production from when they were shut down for 8 weeks during COVID. So it's just been the perfect storm. And a lot of automakers are struggling to keep up with demand, and dealer lots are very thin.
That's on the way in the second half of the show. But first, the state of Michigan may have reached agreement with attorneys representing residents of Flint over the water crisis that poisoned an entire city, but not all city residents are on board with the agreement. This week, a federal judge from Detroit is hearing arguments in Genesee County in a special hearing from a cohort of folks who don't agree with the terms of the settlement, which is valued at $641 million. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody has been covering the proceedings, and he joins us now. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
What are some reasons why folks in Flint have questions or concerns or just outright reject the settlement with the state?
Residents of Flint have many questions and have many objections to this settlement. $641 million is a lot of money. But when you think about the fact that 50,000 people registered to be part of this settlement, that money begins to drop significantly as much as an individual may get. And there's also questions about how that money will be divided and the measurements that will help decide who gets more money than other people. One of the most significant objections that residents of Flint have is over a part of a requirement that residents have undergone a bone scan test. And the idea of the test is just to determine how much lead is present in an individual's bones. That may give an indication of what their exposure was during the water crisis. But there are questions about the device, which itself had not been approved for use on human beings, and whether the evidence that the device shows actually shows exposure during the water crisis. Then there's just people who think that the lawyers are asking for way too much money as part of this settlement. So residents of Flint have brought up several significant concerns about what this settlement means.
Steve, I understand that the former mayor of Flint, Karen Weaver, made an appearance. She wanted to speak to the judge. What did she have to say?
Mayor Weaver, one of the things she wanted to talk about was the need for corrective justice in the case of this settlement. She wanted to urge the judge to make sure the settlement, you know, addresses the problems that were caused by the water crisis. And she's not sure that this settlement, as it's currently constructed, does that. She pointed out, for example, that, yes, it's $641 million, which is a lot of money. But if you remember, there are tens of thousands of plaintiffs in this case. By comparison, she pointed out, Michigan State University settled with a little over 300 women who were abused by Dr. Larry Nassar for $500 million. Hmm. So she views that this is not an adequate compensation for the citizens of Flint.
Steve, is there any indication when Judge Judith Levy is going to respond to what people had to say to her this week?
The judge has said she expects to make a decision on giving final approval to this settlement in the next several months. Now, there are a lot of things for her to consider in that time, but she was, you know, she did appreciate what the citizens of Flint were mentioning during the hearing on Tuesday. Although she did say it did show that, you know, some of the limits that exist in the legal system.
Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody. Steve, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
live in Southeast Michigan, maybe parts north too, and if you've been outside for more than 30 seconds this week, you've no doubt noticed 2021 is quite the year for mosquitoes. With us today is Bill Stanusik. He directs the Saginaw County Mosquito Abatement Commission. Needless to say, he's a busy man this summer, but is giving us a few minutes of his time to talk bug shop. Bill, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Appreciate it.
Now, it's not just me, right? There are more mosquitoes than usual in circulation.
Oh, it's certainly not just you, and the phone calls prove that. And as I've look outwardly from my concern here in Saginaw County to other communities, a lot south of us and west of us, I think a lot of us are going through the same thing. Lots of mosquitoes.
How do you track the numbers?
You know, it's interesting now. It's the phone calls, I could say, but truly with integrated mosquito management program, and I know that's a mouthful, and there's fun acronyms, IMM, but this integration of, so we're trying to manage this mosquito population. So yes, we monitor with different types of mosquito traps. It's pretty basic, using different baits from CO2, like what we exhale, that's carbon dioxide. Using that as bait, we can go out and place these in the environment and track the mosquito population throughout the season. And they are certainly, in some cases, our traps are being overflowed with a variety of mosquitoes.
Well, what do we mean when we say overflowing? Like, what would you expect to see on a typical summer night for mosquitoes? And how does that compare with what you're seeing this year?
Yeah, so I think everyone can agree that during the summer, we're probably out, and depending on if you're in the woods or maybe in a low area, at sunset, you may have to put a little repellent on or a couple slaps, but it's tolerable. So in a trap, that may be, let's say, 100 or so in a night was collected. Now when you're trying to walk to your car just to go to work and it feels like you're eating them as you're walking there, you're likely looking at 1,000. And in some cases, I can put some traps out and get 10,000 mosquitoes in one, you know, putting it out at sunset and collecting it after the sunrise.
10,000 mosquitoes.
Yes.
Oh, that's incredible.
And unfortunately, collecting those 10,000 mosquitoes doesn't seem to make a difference for that an individual in that woodlot. So it speaks to the true number of mosquitoes that are out there in
right.
a given time.
So why is this happening? I know that a lot of areas are experiencing wet weather, but what is going on?
Yeah, and I can get much into the details on water tables and such, but the simple answer, April, is rainfall. And I know a lot of us and those that are involved in agriculture and farmers, boy, we started out with such a dry spring, wondering when the rains would come. And then June, the end of June, here comes the rain. And I know locally in Saginaw County, up here around the Saginaw Bay area, some areas got over 6 inches of rain in nearly one weekend. So I know that rain was also received down in Southeast Michigan and portions of the west side of the state and central part of the state also. So rainfall equals standing water equals mosquitoes. And the more rain, the more standing water there is, so the more mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes come from the standing water because that's where they lay their eggs, in those low depressions that flood with substantial rainfall. And we're happy. My guess is from this exorbitant amount of rain in many areas, we're hatching out eggs from, in some cases, many years, because it's been a while in some areas that they've received a rain that's actually flooded these low areas.
So that's a thing? Mosquito eggs laid in prior years can hatch now?
You got it. Yes. Mosquitoes have been at this a lot longer than we've tried to control them, although I'm sure we've been slapping since mankind arrived. But certainly they are capable. And again, there's many different species of mosquitoes that have different egg-laying behavior. But for the sake of what we're talking about now, these are the mosquitoes, the nuisance mosquitoes that are biting everybody. And there's a handful of species within that, but they all share the characteristic that after they blood feed, and it's only the females that bite, and they blood feed so they can create their eggs, you know, through mating and such. But so the blood's necessary for egg production. So after they blood feed, they look for a place to lay their eggs. And these nuisance mosquitoes look for low depressions in our natural habitats and artificial in the case of buckets, or even artificial in the case of roadside ditches. But think of the swamps, the floodplains that are around our low areas, that are around our great state, that hold water and the more water, the more mosquitoes.
Yeah. This crazy, crazy proliferation, what does this mean in Saginaw County, I guess, in terms of public health?
Yeah, so there's two ways to think of nuisance mosquitoes. And when we talk public health mosquito control, we tend to think of the mosquito-borne virus that's out in the environment and the state. And people are very familiar with West Nile virus in the state of Michigan and in North America, for that matter. So that's kind of the textbook correlation with public health and mosquitoes and mosquito control. But when you have a nuisance of this amount, I think we can all agree that the stress that this puts on us as individuals, whether we're slapping or looking at our children getting bitten, I argue it does affect public health to some in some circumstance. So we are certainly out there trying to do our best to expedite getting relief to communities.
We haven't heard a ton so far this year about West Nile virus or Eastern equine encephalitis or Zika. The summer is young, I suppose, but does the fact that that conversation hasn't cropped up, does that mean we're not yet having problems with those diseases?
Yeah, we have certainly not, and we do quite a bit of sampling of mosquitoes. The different, I'm going to use the term vector, and when we say vector, that applies to a species, in this case, mosquitoes, that's capable of transmitting a disease. And to date, in our quite robust sampling, we have not found any West Nile virus, and I believe the state has yet to find West Nile virus in mosquitoes, and that's looking at different public health efforts, whether it's a standard public health department or another mosquito control district submitting samples, they have not found any positives. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing, as we're not finding that there's enough virus out there to detect yet. Being amplified, when it arrives, it normally amplifies over time. With West Nile virus, it amplifies in birds and mosquitoes. And if it goes unchecked, and of course, weather dictates a lot of this too, you can have, you know, a public health concern with these arboviruses or mosquito-borne viruses.
That was Bill Stanusik with the Saginaw County Mosquito Abatement Commission. In just a moment, artist Lisa Wad talks about florifying a lakeside party store in the Thumb. That's after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Is there anything more gorgeous and more fleeting than a freshly picked flower? It's kind of the opposite of the many single-use plastics that populate our lives. Detroit artist Lisa Wad is preparing a brand new installation in the tip of the mitten this weekend that marries these seemingly unlike things. It's called Party Store. And if you're lucky, you can be one of those who get to see it in person before it's gone. Lisa Wad joins us now. Lisa, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me here.
I know that you've talked to us before about your work as a botanical artist, but for those who might be seeing your work for the first time, can you explain what you do?
Yes. So I call myself a large-scale botanical installation artist. Large-scale, something immersive that you can go inside of. Botanical, plants and flowers. Installation, that means it's not in a vase. It's something that's happening around you or above you. And artist, well, I think we all know what that is.
Right. It's for those who might be aware of an installation you did in 2015 called Flower House. It was widely shared and widely covered. It was something that you did in a house that had been foreclosed, you know, something that a lot of folks in Michigan see in their towns. Will you remind folks what the motivation was behind Flower House?
I simply wanted to fill a house with flowers. I had seen something similar happening in Paris for a fashion show, and I wanted to do something that was really inclusive and invited everyone who could make it to Detroit. So, you know, we have a resource here that is empty, foreclosed, abandoned houses. And so I was able to get one for $250 on city auction. So the price was right. And I worked together with hundreds of people to create this really beautiful large-scale installation for almost 4,000 people came through and millions saw it online.
Your current installation that you're working on is going to be unveiled this weekend. It'll be something people can go and see for 3 short days, or of course, enjoy from their homes via Instagram or other places. It's called Party Store. Can you tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind it? Did you go to a lot of party stores growing up?
Well, I will say I was invited to participate in the Port Austin Artist in Residency program, and they asked how long I wanted to come up for this summer, and I asked if I could break up my time. So I went up for a week in May to meet people and to tour around. My work is very site specific, and so I didn't know what I wanted to do until I got there. And I actually saw a lot of similarities between my hometown of Petoskey, Michigan, and Port Austin when it comes to tourism. And so, you know, one thing we've all done as a tourist in Michigan is visit a party store, which now I know is a very regional term. If you go to a party store in other states, you are buying streamers and balloons. But here it's, you know, things you need to drink on the boat when you're headed out on the water. So I wanted to base my installation in a party store, and the community really helped me find the perfect spot for this weekend's installation.
So a party store, yeah, it's a carryout. It's a place you go to buy any number of beverages or snacks, and they're really a part of life. What is it that you're hoping to do with the installation this weekend? What's it going to look like?
So this weekend's installation will... I wish I had a more romantic metaphor to use, but it's going to be like when you hire someone to come into your attic and spray in insulation. I want the flowers to be sticking to the walls and the ceiling and kind of globbed in the corners and everything. So this isn't going to be precious, perfectly placed flowers. It's going to look as if the flowers took over this place. Like if you go into a building that's been closed up for quite a while and you see cobwebs everywhere, but instead of cobwebs, we've got flowers.
I love it. I mean, in that every time we enter a party store or, you know, a convenience store or a gas station, literally almost every single thing you see is plastic. This is going to florify this place. Do you have an estimate on how many different kinds of plants and flowers you're using?
For this installation, I am sourcing 100% Michigan-grown flowers. So that I've reached out to the flower farmers that I know and a few that I don't know, and I asked them to send me everything that is seasonal and blooming now. So it's going to be a surprise for me and really so fun to see what shows up. But I will also say that I've been experimenting with artificial flowers. As we all get into kind of the winter blues here in Michigan, I was craving color. And of course, nothing is very colorful. So I went out in two masks and went to some resale stores and bought a bunch of fake flowers that I could experiment with. So this is going to be a hybrid between those fake flowers and the real flowers. And I like to think that even the fake flowers are local and representative of our community because they came from the community.
Wow. I mean, is this new for you? Have you ever worked with synthetic flowers before?
I did work with artificial flowers when I did the set for Danny Brown's Best Life on the Jimmy Fallon show. They wouldn't allow me to have enough time to work with fresh flowers. So we had to decorate the car for the set with artificial.
So what kind of a shift is that for you?
I actually don't think it's much of a shift. And I really enjoy moving away from such a perishable product. However, they aren't alive. They don't smell. Well, they smell a little bit like someone's old perfume sometimes. But there's benefits to both. And I enjoy working with both of them.
What happens to the perishable flowers that you use in your installations normally?
Everything in my installations is composted or recycled or reused. You should see my storage. It's full of all kinds of interesting things that have been in many installations.
And so your synthetic flowers are now taking up a bigger part of that, I imagine.
Oh, yes.
Can we talk a little bit more about the party store and the space of it? You know, these places bring up a lot of things for people when they go in. You know, they might remember going in with their parents, their aunts and uncles, you know, to pick something up, or older brothers and sisters when they were kids. They might remember stopping there themselves. But the feeling of, I guess, abundance is kind of a thing whenever you walk into a party store. Is that something that you were wanting to explore a little, or proliferation? Is that something you wanted to explore with this work this weekend?
Yes. So Your question is kind of making me think of two things. One is I picked this building not knowing anything about the history or who owned it or anything. And of course, immersing myself in the Port Austin community, I've learned a lot about it. It was Al's party store, and Al passed away last year. And I've actually heard a lot of really wonderful stories about him. And just like you were hinting at, people saying, I used to come here to get penny candy. I used to ride my bike here. And, you know, we'd stop here before we went camping and that kind of thing. So there are a lot of really prolific memories around this particular building and something I really enjoy about site-specific work. And the other thing that I'm thinking of is there is definitely going to be something to think about when you come into this party store that I'm creating. It is going to be filled with flowers where there would normally be lots of plastic bottles and packages full of these convenient foods that we all love to grab and snack on and everything. So I'm kind of proposing this is a platform for a conversation. If you're up for it, and you can come in and think about what you normally see in a place like this and your responsibility for what happens to those products after we eat the goods that are inside of that plastic.
Yeah. If you're just joining in, I'm speaking with botanical artist Lisa Wadd. Her latest installation will transform a former party store in Port Austin. The exhibition runs through this weekend. You know, this is a place where you go in and you buy something, use it once, and usually never again. That's true of the flowers that you use as well. But it's kind of gotten hard to escape. You know, single-use plastics are so much a part of life. It feels like we've barely scratched the surface moving away from plastic straws and maybe toward paper straws or reusable straws and stuff. Is this something that's been on your mind a lot?
It certainly has. And as I moved it into the statement of this project, it's certainly come to the forefront of my mind. And because I'm talking about this, because I'm making it a part of this project, does not mean that I am doing it right. There is waste even associated with this project, which is horrifying to me. But I think we need to have these conversations. And if this project can start some of those conversations where what I'm hoping is that, you know, we're coming out of some pretty serious home life after this pandemic, kind of honing our perhaps food compost, our recycling, everything has its place in our house because we've really streamlined being in them. What I'm hoping is that as we start to go out in the world and travel again, we can bring some of those practices with us where we don't think of things as disposable, but as reusable and recyclable.
If you're just joining in, I'm speaking with botanical artist Lisa Wadd. Her latest installation will transform a former party store in Port Austin. The exhibition runs through this weekend. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the technique that you use in your installations. A lot of it is very specific to wherever it is you have to be working. And it seems like there's not one Lisa Wadd way to festoon a place with flowers. But at the same time, you have a way of having flowers appear to explode, say, out of a corner or out of a duct or some sort of conduit. Can you talk a little bit about how you put these things together and how you try to create, you know, some motion and maybe a little bit of narrative even just with how you're arranging things?
Well, firstly, thank you for making me into a verb. I am honored. Sure. So I am committed to being foam free. This green stuff that you find, you know, in grandma's basement that literally never decomposes. I don't work with foam. It's full of chemicals that make me sick, that make flora sick, that make people in the factories that make the foam sick. So I really embrace doing installations that can often and do look different the first day than they do the third day, the 3-day installation. You know, if I can fold in some water buckets, some reusable water tubes, sure, but I actually really enjoy watching things change. And I have actually seen some photographer friends of mine pick up on that and book a ticket for the beginning of the weekend and the end of the weekend. I actually noticed this first with my photographer for this project, Chris Gerard. When he came to Flower House, I saw that he did that. And I could tell that he was very attuned to that change in the aesthetics.
Can you tell us a little bit about what installation is like? I mean, I know you often have help in the forms of volunteers or friends who give you a hand, but I've got to believe the days and hours leading up to an opening are just full of furious activity because, like, these are live flowers in many cases. You've got to get them up.
Yes. Well, I have perfected. Well, I won't say perfected. I am working toward a better installation week when it is leading up to one of these exhibitions. I like to build in time to really enjoy the process. I, yes, could do an installation on my own, but I really enjoy collaboration. I prefer to bring in people from the community to help and to give me their two cents and to change it and to improve the project. So there's a furious schedule, as you said, until Friday. You know, lots of chicken wire, lots of processing flowers, fresh flowers, those fake flowers. And I dare say, I think it'll be a fun few days.
How many people will be helping to set up Party Store?
I think we've got about 50 people volunteering for Party Store.
Wow. You know, you mentioned that, you know, there'd been this transition with Al, the guy who used to own this spot. But what was it about its location that really appealed to you for this?
So as I was looking around in Port Austin for a space, I was looking at stores that were ice cream shops or small grocery stores that were empty. I didn't want to kick anyone out for the weekend. I looked at one that was an ice cream store. It was a little too big. And so I moved on to a grocery store that was the perfect aesthetic, but it was in a very residential neighborhood. And I wanted it to feel a little bit more natural in the surroundings around it because I wanted that feeling of finding this kind of oasis. And literally, Al's Party Store is in the middle. So it was kind of like that classic, I don't know, like children's tale, like not this, but this. And then it was the perfect one. So it's a bit residential, but very wooded and a great size. And I think it'll be perfect for how we've set up folks to come in and explore it.
You know, you mentioned that you've got this whole team of folks working with you. Can I just ask, how do you fund an installation like this?
Sure. So this one is funded directly with ticket sales. And so obviously it's a bit of a leap of faith because I make the announcement and then I hope the tickets sell. We're on our way, but there still are a few left, wink, wink. And I would love really for as many people as possible to come and see it.
Is it hard to sell or to convince funders and curators that you work with on helping support what you do with your work? Let me just say, like, there's sort of a conversation in the contemporary art world about the more ephemeral forms right now. Like, the things that people do that are more of a performance piece or things that are a form of social practice where you design something for people to go out and do themselves. And I wonder if that's sort of broken in some ground for you.
I certainly think so. There is a ways to go in that because it's hard to know who to trust. So here I am. Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm up from Detroit. I want to do this thing and it's going to be very cool. Trust me. Oh, how long will it be up for? Well, just 3 days. So I can see there's a bit of a leap of faith there too. So I think what I'm thankful for as far as my practice and what I enjoy and how I do things is it really does involve the community. That's a big part of it. If I just came in and said, ta-da, here's this thing, there's no ownership, there's no buy-in, you know, people will bring their families and say, I did this corner, you know, I did these flowers here, or they're working as a docent, that really helps me kind of ingratiate myself into communities where I'm doing work.
I think the closest a lot of us have ever gotten to the kind of work that you do is either the floral floats in 4th of July parades or a really beautifully designed flower arrangement, you know, for a special event. Are there other botanical artists that you follow or maybe that you take inspiration from or who've sort of shown you what's possible in this space?
Yes. I mean, with flowers, there are a lot of folks who've done client work and then come over into art, and we kind of go back and forth. One person that I think is doing extraordinary work is Maurice Harris. He's called Bloom and Plume, and he is in Los Angeles. Another woman I'm thinking of is Rebecca Louise Law. She's firmly in art and does a lot of work with dried flowers.
Well, Lisa Wadd, thank you so much for telling us more about this, and we're looking forward to seeing your work in Port Austin this weekend.
Thank you so much, April.
Coming up, the scarcity of new vehicles in Michigan's auto industries.
They miscalculated that. There was pent-up demand.
It may be this problem is going to mean long-term changes to the way auto companies work. We'll be right back with that story in a moment. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. I walked into a Ford dealership in Southeast Michigan last week. The sales floor was full of staff, everybody on the phone, talking to customers, one or two in person. Ford is blessed with high demand right now for models like the new Mach-E and the electrified F-150 Lightning. But the salesman who I talked to looked exhausted and heaved a big sigh. I asked him how things were going, and he gestured out the window at rows and rows of shiny inventory on the lot. And he said, out of all these vehicles, only about 10 of them are new. There's scarcity enough to roil not just Ford, but several players in Michigan's auto industry, although Ford may be getting the worst of it right now. With us to discuss shortages in supply are Jamie Leroux, an automotive reporter for the Detroit Free Press. Jamie, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Also with us, Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain and operations management at Michigan State University. Steve, good to have you.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Jamie, the automakers tell us that one of the main reasons why they don't have new cars to sell right now is a wider semiconductor chip shortage. Can you talk about chips and why there are so few of them available for cars and trucks right now?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's been a problem that's been going on since earlier this year. And basically, it started during COVID. As people started working from home, they started to use more of their laptops and cellular phones, all the things that the semiconductor chips go in. And then rolled into that was the fact that the automakers had idled production during COVID for 8 weeks and had kind of put their orders for these chip parts on hold. So now it comes, the industry comes.
I guess, and sorry to interrupt, I guess under other circumstances, other kinds of crises and recessions, that would have been a pretty normal thing to do, right?
Yeah, it would. And, you know, like I say, most automakers, they figured once they even start production again, they're going to not have the same kind of demand that they did previously. They miscalculated that. And there was very big demand, pent-up demand, when they restarted the factories, and they couldn't get the chip parts. And between the demand from other industries, small electronics, along with demand from the auto industry, there just aren't enough chips. And it's created quite a problem, and they can't complete a lot of the cars because these chip parts, and I keep calling them chip parts because it's not just a semiconductor chip, there could be thousands of these chips in just one car part. And so this is the problem. And then you roll into that, there's been other problems. There were storms earlier this year in the South that shut down some production, and that put automakers behind. They're still trying to ramp up production from when they were shut down for 8 weeks during COVID. So it's just been the perfect storm. And a lot of automakers are struggling to keep up with demand, and dealer lots are very thin.
Steve Melnick, business leaders really across the economy are under enormous pressure to make quick pivots and limit short-term disruptions and ensure a high degree of agility in their supply chains. Should we be surprised when unexpected circumstances like this cause everything to hit the fan?
Not really, because I'm going to build on what was said previously. The reality is most companies, especially the auto industry, doesn't understand the new realities. And the new realities require a very different approach to supply chains. Number one, the recovery from the pandemic was rather unusual. It's what's known as a K recovery. And what a K recovery means is that the people who work the minimum wages, the service jobs, they basically were hit the hardest. People like myself, professionals who could work from home, didn't. And they recovered very quickly. So when there was an opportunity to buy computers or buy cars, they were able to do it. But the problem that you had was when you're dealing with chips, you're dealing with a product that's in scarce demand. There's not a lot of companies, areas that can make chips. And you're also dealing with a product where the stuff that the auto industry was looking for was rather old technology. And this chip capacity had been dedicated to the new technology, which was being used in the gaming computers, business computers, whatever. And this was a reality in which you couldn't look at a computer company, a chip making company, and say, I'm Ford, put me at the top of the pile. Doesn't work that way. The irony is that the auto industry was not impacted evenly. Give you an example.
Yeah, I want to say Honda is in reasonable shape right now in terms of its supply,
right? No, Toyota's
right?
in better shape. Toyota is in better shape.
Toyota, yeah, okay.
You know why? Because what they had done that the rest of the auto industry didn't do is they looked and developed visibility in the supply chain. So they looked beyond the first tier. They looked to the second tier, the third tier, the fourth tier. They saw that there was going to be a chip problem. And they did something which for many people was just totally shocking. They kept inventory. Toyota, which had been the classic example of a company which had run lean, for many companies, that means no inventory. They were putting in inventory. They could see it. Now, here's something to think about. If you're going to develop visibility and talk about agility, you have to have good relations with your supply chain. The auto industry traditionally has not been known for its relationships.
So, Jamie, what are the Michigan-based automakers doing for now to cope with the high demand and this huge supply problem?
Well, I'll jump on what Steve is talking about in terms of supplier relations, because that in many ways has put General Motors in probably the best position of the Detroit Three, because they too have good relationships with their suppliers. They've worked hard on that and they are working tirelessly. They have like a 24-hour team that is in touch all the way down to the fourth tier supplier to redirect whatever chip parts they can get their hands on to their highest profit, most in-demand vehicles, which are large SUVs and pickups. And so they've been able to maintain production of those vehicles by redirecting parts that might have gone to, you know, the Malibu, for example. Instead, they sent it to a Silverado. And that's helped them quite a bit. That being said, all three of them have had to idle plants. They've had to shut down lines. They've had to stop production periodically because they just didn't have the parts. And they still are doing that. Ford is still doing that. And GM has a strategy where they build shy, is what they call it, where they'll build a vehicle just shy of whatever chip part is needed, park that vehicle, and then wait for the chip part to come in and then finish production and get it to a dealership. And that's worked, and they've been actually able to clean up a lot of that. And so that's been one of the strategies. The build shy strategy is one that GM has employed.
That's so crazy to think about all those vehicles sitting there with everything in place except the chips. If you're just joining us, my guests today are Jamie Leroux, who reports on automotive industry issues for the Detroit Free Press, and Professor Stephen Melnick in supply chain and operations management at Michigan State University. Steve, Americans aren't really used to this kind of shortage. And at this point, at least, those who can seem willing to pay more for what they can get rather than waiting for prices to go down. Do you think that's unique to American consumerism?
No, but essentially that's a short-term fix. I was reading an article about the problems that are now being encountered in terms of used cars, new cars. And in addition to the comment that Jamie talked about, which is building shy, another response has been to build with fewer features. And we're starting to see some features critical have been stripped off. But the short term is, yes, companies are paying more. But the reality is that's attacking the symptom. If you're going to attack the root cause, and this is what I think differentiates the good companies from the not so good, you've got to take a step back and say, okay, what we have here is a result of us failing to understand or manage our supply chain properly. And I'm glad to hear that GM is doing what it's doing, because in 2008, when we did a study on the recession, GM was not one of the companies suppliers talked about in glowing terms. Mm-hmm. And what you have to do is you have to understand that your supply net is really important, because it gives you a lot of visibility into the world. And what Toyota learned from 2011, when it got hit by the tsunami, I don't know how many of you remembers watching in real time, the television where you saw the airports being wiped out.
Right.
What they learned very quickly is that they didn't manage the supply chain beyond the first tier, and they went and did that. So in the short term, yes, let's pay more. Let's get it. We're going to be in a bidding war. The result of that is going to be what you're seeing right now, which is car prices are increasing faster than we've ever seen them before. But that's a short-term action. The long-term is, let's get to understand our supply chain. Let's build better relations. Let's work together. Let's share information. And that means you have to be more than interested in just treating the supply chain management game as a poker game. What you lose is what I win.
Right. Jamie, are there other factors that are coming into play for the automakers? We know that retail and other sectors are having trouble staffing up right now. Does that extend to automotive?
Well, I just wanted to jump on something else that Steve was talking about in terms of managing things. GM has also done something that is kind of new and good for them, which is managing their dealer network as well as communication. They've started some technology that will allow dealers to track when a vehicle has been built and put on a truck so they can communicate with their customer. It's on its way. It should be here in this many days. And other ways that they can look it through the supply chain, the production chain.
What's the value of that at the point of sale?
Well, it's helped dealers quite a bit, because most of these customers go on these lots like you did, and they don't see any new cars. And in fact, even used cars, it's thin. If you don't have a new car, it's hard to get a trade-in, right?
Right.
So if you have a dealer who can go in the system, place your order, and tell you when it will be there, you're much more willing to make that purchase. And so this technology has created transparency for the dealer network, which has helped them secure their customers. It's made them more efficient. They are reaching out. A lot of dealers right now across brands are reaching out to people in leases and offering them early outs on their leases so that they can get that vehicle back and sell it.
I feel like that's the equivalent of giving someone a great deal on selling their house, though. Like, if you get out of your lease, you have to be able to have another car.
That's the thing right now. If you have a used car, you're going to get a ton of money for it, you know, but at the same time, you better have another car to drive until the prices for new cars and then even buying a used car go down, because the prices to buy are very high. It's just like the housing market.
Hope you like Toyotas.
Yeah, so that's been one thing that GM has done as well. I didn't mean to distract your other question. So what was the other question you wanted to ask me?
What kind of situation is Detroit facing in terms of labor shortages for automotive assembly and operations?
Well, I wouldn't say they have a shortage, because the plants have their staffing, okay? But what they do want are temporary employees that fill in for the permanent employees that have to go on vacation or take time off or whatnot. That's where they're having a problem, as everybody is right now. Anybody who pays $15 or less an hour is struggling to get people. People are making that on unemployment. And why would you want to take a temporary job when you're not even sure what kind of hours you're going to get. You may be called in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to come in and work the night shift, and you've had no warning. In the past, those were good jobs. They paid, you know, $16 an hour, I think, and they could lead to something permanent full time. Now, people are looking at that saying, you know, I don't know if I want to do this. And I wrote a story too about the other problem is they test for marijuana. And a lot of people don't want to be tested for marijuana for those jobs. And the plant management has pushed to not test for that because it's legal in Michigan. Why are you testing for it? But right. They still do.
You know, I'm thinking about, Steve, I'm thinking about the things you said about some very embedded problems in how the automotive sector reacts to supply chain issues. And I'm thinking about what just happened with the pandemic and the fact that demand for semiconductors is probably not going down anytime soon. If anything, there are probably even more products and services that are going to rely on chips and chip parts. Do you think there is a return to normal? Like how should the auto industry be thinking about this? And maybe where does that leave us as car customers? Are we going to see a point at which supply of cars gets to some sort of closer equilibrium with demand?
The answer is yeah. I expect that by the end of this year, we're going to start to see car prices go down, especially in the used car prices. I'm going to expect to see the chip production because of the fact that, for example, the TSMC in Taiwan is going to ramp up production and give priority to the automotive. We're going to start to see a return. And the reason we're going to start to see a return is because what we're being hit by right now is a perfect storm of developments. In addition to the fact that there's now been a recovery and people are demanding cars, you also had something else that contributed to it, and that's what happened in the rental car market. Last year, when we had the pandemic, rental car companies like Enterprise and Hertz, they had a ton of inventory, which was cars. And guess what they did with those cars? They sold them, which is one reason last year, if you wanted to buy a used car, it was a great market. Now what's happening is we're seeing a recovery. The rental car companies need cars. So when you're going out and buying a car, you're not just simply competing with someone else in your neighborhood. You're also competing with Hertz, with Enterprise. And we're going to start to see that demand ease off when the rental car companies get their supply back online and they get adequate number. And I expect to see that by third quarter, we're going to start to see a return to some form of normalcy. But the reality is it's going to be good, but my question is still the one I posed to you at the beginning. How are the companies going to react? And oh, by the way, this is not the only problem you're going to start to see facing that's coming out of the supply chain. You're also going to start to see problems with things like cybersecurity. And that's something else that's coming down the pipe.
Can I just jump on that for a second?
Please, Jamie, yes.
Yeah, what Steve is saying is really spot on because Mary Barra, GM CEO, has said now a couple of times in different venues that GM will not be going back to the days of oversupplying their dealerships and offering heavy incentives. They have learned now that having lean inventory and managing it really efficiently is a better way of doing business. And while we'll have more inventory when things return to normal, we're not going back to the days where you're seeing those overflowing lots and, you know, dealers offering these crazy deals to push inventory out. Those days are going to be in the past, according to GM.
They have to be. It costs too much nowadays for a car.
Jamie Leroux is an automotive reporter with the Detroit Free Press. We've also been talking with Professor Stephen Melnick of Michigan State University, a professor of supply chain and operations management. Steve, Jamie, thank you for shedding some light on this for us, and especially the long term.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Stateside's produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Ronia Cabansag, Chantel Phillips, Lucas Pollock, and Mary Claire Zowell. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Great to have you with us. See you tomorrow.